the pillow, whose indistinct nature did nothing to disguise its hostile intonation. The hammering was repeated, and Jemmy, who did wake up cheerful in the mornings, popped up in his trundle, looking like a red-headed dandelion gone to seed. "Somebody's knocking," he informed Roger.
"Who are they?"
"Mm-hmm." Repressing an urge to groan, he rose and went to unbolt the door. Hiram Crombie stood outside, looking more dour than usual in the milky half-light. Evidently not a happy riser either, Roger reflected.
"My wife's old mother's passed in the night," he informed Roger without preamble.
"Passed what?" asked Jemmy with interest, poking his dishevelled head out from behind Roger's leg. He rubbed one eye with a fist and yawned widely.
"Mr. Sternaway passed a stone. He showed it to me in Jermaine."
"Mr. Crombie's mother-in-law has died," Roger said, putting a quelling hand on Jem's head with an apologetic cough toward Crombie. "I'm sorry to hear that, Mr. Crombie."
"Aye."
Mr. Crombie appeared indifferent to condolence.
"My do Lindsay says as you ken a bit of scripture for the burying. The wife's wondering would you maybe come and say a word at the grave."
"Murdo said?"
"Oh."
The Dutch family, that was it. Jamie had forced him to speak at the graves.
"Aye, of course."
He cleared his throat by reflex. His voice was desperately hoarse, as usual in the mornings, until he'd had a cup of something hot. No wonder Crombie was looking dubious.
"Of course," he repeated more strongly. "Is there anything we could do to help?"
Crombie made a small, negative gesture.
"The women will have her laid out by now, I expect," he said, with the briefest of glances at the mound Brianna made in the bed. "We'll start the digging after breakfast. With luck, we'll have her under before snow falls."
He lifted a sharp chin toward an opaque sky, the soft grey of Adso's belly fur, then nodded, turned on his heel, and left without further congenialities.
"Daddy, look!"
Roger looked down to see Jem, fingers hooked in the corners of his mouth, pulled down to simulate the inverted U of Hiram Crombie's customary expression. Small red brows wrinkled in a ferocious scowl, making the resemblance startling. Surprised into laughter, Roger gasped and choked, then coughed until he doubled over, wheezing.
"Are you all right?"
Brianna had unearthed herself and was sitting up in bed, squint-eyed with sleep, but looking concerned.
"Aye, fine."
The words came out in a thready wheeze, nearly soundless. He took a breath and hawked deeply, expectorating a repellent glob into his hand for lack of a handkerchief.
"Ew," said the tender wife of his bosom, recoiling. "Let me see, Daddy," said his son and heir, jostling for a look. "Ew."
Roger stepped outside and wiped his hand in the wet grass by the door. It was cold out, so early. But Crombie was undoubtedly right. Snow was on the way again. The air had that soft, muffled feel to it.
"So, old Mrs. Wilson is dead."
Brianna had come out after him, a shawl wrapped round her shoulders.
"That's too bad.
Imagine coming so far and then dying in a strange place before you've even had time to settle."
"Well, she had her family with her, at least. I expect she wouldn't have wanted to be left alone to die in Scotland."
"Hmm." Bree brushed strands of hair off her cheeks. She'd put her hair into a thick plait for sleeping, but a good bit of it had escaped from captivity and was waving up round her face in the cold, humid air.
"Should I go up there, do you think?"
"Pay our respects. He said they've laid the old lady out already."
She snorted, white wisps of breath from her nostrils momentarily making him think of dragons.
"It can't be later than 7 a.m. It's still bloody dark out. And I don't believe for a minute that his wife and sister have been laying out the old lady by candlelight. Hiram would balk at the expense of the extra candle, for one thing."
"No, he felt itchy about asking a favour. So he was trying to get under your skin about your wife being a lazy slattern."
That was perceptive, Roger thought, amused.
particularly as she hadn't seen Crombie's eloquent glance at her recumbent form.
"What's the slattern?"
Jemmy inquired, picking up instantly on anything vaguely improper-sounding.
"That's a lady who's no lady," Roger informed him, "and a bad housekeeper to boot."
"That's one of the words that Mrs. Bug will wash out your mouth with soap if she hears you say it," amended his wife, with ungrammatical acuity. Roger was still attired in nothing but a nightshirt, and his legs and feet were freezing. Jem was hopping around barefoot too, but without the slightest sign of being cold.
"Mummy is not one," Roger said firmly, taking Jem's hand. "Come on, chum. Let's nip up to the prairie while Mummy makes breakfast."
"Thanks for the vote of confidence,"
Brianna said, yawning.
"I'll take up a jar of honey or something to the Crombies later."
"I go too,"
Jemmy announced promptly. Brianna hesitated for a moment, then looked at Roger and raised her brows. Jem had never seen a dead person.
Roger lifted one shoulder.
It would have been a peaceful death, and it was, God knew, a fact of life on the mountain. He didn't suppose that seeing Mrs. Wilson's body would give the child nightmare, though knowing Jem, it was quite likely to lead to a number of loud and embarrassing public questions. A bit of preparatory explanation might not be out of place, he reflected.
"Sure," he told Jem, "but first we have to go up to the big house after breakfast and borrow a Bible from Granda."
He found Jamie at breakfast, the warm oatmeal smell of fresh porridge wrapping him like a blanket as he stepped into the kitchen. Before he could explain his errand, Mrs. Bug had set him down with a bowl of his own, a jug of honey, a plate of savoury fried bacon, hot toast dripping butter, and a fresh cup of something dark and fragrant that looked like coffee. Jem was next to him, already smeared with honey and buttered to the ears. For a traitorous instant, he wondered whether Brianna was perhaps a bit of a sluggard, though certainly never a slattern. Then he glanced across the table at Claire, uncombed hair standing on end as she blinked sleepily at him over the toast, and generously concluded that it probably wasn't a conscious choice on Bree's part, but rather the influence of genetics. Claire roused at once, though, when he explained his errand between bites of bacon and toast.
"Old Mrs. Wilson?" she asked with interest.
"What did she die of? Did Mr. Crombie say?" Roger shook his head, swallowing oatmeal.
"Only that she'd passed in the night. I suppose they found her dead. Her heart, maybe. She must have been at least 80.
"She was about 5 years older than I am," Claire said dryly. "She told me."
"Oh." "Mm-hmm."
Clearing his throat hurt, and he took a sip of the hot, dark stuff in his cup. It was a brew of roasted chicory and acorns, but not that bad.
"I hope you didn't tell her how old you are, Sassenach."
Jamie reached across and snared the last piece of toast. Mrs. Bug, ever vigilant, whisked the plate away to refill it.
"I'm not that careless," Claire said, dabbing a forefinger delicately into a smear of honey and licking it. "They already think I've made some sort of pact with the devil. If I told them my age, they'd be sure of it."
Roger chuckled, but thought privately that she was right. The marks of her ordeal had nearly vanished, bruises faded, and the bridge of her nose healed straight and clean. Even unkempt and puffy-eyed from sleep, she was more than handsome, with lovely skin, lushly thick curly hair, and an elegance of feature undreamed of among the Highland fisherfolk, to say nothing of the eyes, sherry gold and startling. Add to these natural gifts the 20th-century practices of nutrition and hygiene, she had all of her teeth, white and straight, and she easily appeared a good 20 years younger than other women of her own age. He found that a comforting thought. Perhaps Bree had inherited the art of aging beautifully from her mother as well. He could always make his own breakfast, after all. Jamie had finished his own meal and gone to fetch the Bible. He came back, laying it beside Roger's plate. "We'll go up with you to the burying," he said, nodding at the book. "Mrs. Bug, can you maybe put up a wee basket for the Crombies?"
"Done it already," she informed him,
and plunked a large basket on the table before him, covered with a napkin and bulging with goodies.
"You'll take it, then? I must go tell Arch and fetch my good shawl, and we'll see you at the graveside, aye?"
Brianna came in then, yawning but well-groomed, and set about making Jem presentable, while Claire vanished to find cap and shawl. Roger picked up the Bible, intending to thumb through the Psalms for something suitably sombre but uplifting.
"Maybe the 23rd, he said, half to himself. "Nice and short. Always a classic. And it does mention death, at least."
"Are you going to give a eulogy?" Brianna asked, interested. "Or a sermon?"
"Oh, Christ! I hadn't thought of that," he said in dismay.
He cleared his throat experimentally.
"Is there more coffee?"
He'd been to a great many funerals in Inverness, presided over by the Reverend, and was well aware that the paying customers considered such an event a dismal failure unless the preaching went on for at least half an hour. Granted, beggars couldn't be choosers, and the Crombies couldn't expect...
"Why do you have a Protestant Bible, Dar?"
Bree paused in the act of disentangling a piece of toast from Jemmy's hair, peering over Roger's shoulder.
Surprised, he shut the cover.
But she was right. "King James Version," it said, the letters of the inscription nearly worn away.
"It was given to me," Jamie said.
The reply was casual, but Roger glanced up. There was something odd in Jamie's voice. Brianna heard it too. She shot her father a brief, sharp look. But his face was tranquil as he took a final bite of bacon and wiped his lips.
"Do you want a dram in your coffee, Roger Mac?" he said, nodding at Roger's cup as though it were the most natural thing in the world to offer whiskey with breakfast.
In fact, the notion sounded really appealing, given the immediate prospects. But Roger shook his head.
"No thanks. I'll do."
"Are you sure?"
Brianna transferred the sharp look to him.
"Maybe you should. For your throat."
"It'll be fine," he said shortly.
He was worried about his voice himself. He didn't need solicitude from the red-headed contingent, all three of whom were giving him thoughtful looks that he interpreted as casting extreme doubt upon his speaking abilities. Whiskey might help his throat, but he doubted it would do much for his preaching. And the last thing he wanted was to show up at a funeral reeking of strong drink in front of a lot of strict teetotalers.
"Vinegar," advised Mrs. Bug, bending to take away his plate. "Hot vinegar's the thing. Cuts the phlegm, aye?"
"I'll bet it would," Roger said, smiling despite his misgivings. "But I think I won't, Mrs. Bug. Thanks."
He'd wakened with a slight sore throat and hoped the consumption of breakfast would cure it. It hadn't, and the thought of drinking hot vinegar made his tonsils seize up. He held out his cup for more chicory coffee instead and set his mind to the task ahead.
"Now, does anyone know anything about old Mrs. Wilson?"
"She's dead,"
Jemmy piped up confidently. Everybody laughed, and Jem looked confused, but then joined the laughter, though plainly not having the slightest idea what was funny.
"Good start, sport."
Roger reached out and brushed crumbs from Jemmy's shirt front.
"Might be a point at that. The Reverend had a decent sermon on something in the epistles. The wages of sin is death, but the gift of God is eternal life. I heard him give it more than once. What do you think?"
He raised a brow at Brianna, who frowned in thought and picked up the Bible.
"That would probably work. Does this thing have a concordance?"
"No."
Jamie put down his coffee cup.
"It's in Romans, chapter 6, though."
Seeing the looks of surprise turned upon him, he flushed slightly and jerked his head toward the Bible.
"I had that book in prison," he said. "I read it. Come along, Awawach. Are you ready now?"
The weather was lowering, clouds threatening anything from freezing rain to the first snow of the season, and occasional cold gusts of wind catching cloaks and skirts, bellying them out like sails. The men held tight to their hats, and the women huddled deep in their hoods, all walking with their heads down like sheep pushing stubbornly into the wind.
"Great weather for a funeral," Brianna murmured, pulling her cloak tight around her after one such gust.
"Mm-hmm," Roger responded automatically, obviously unaware of what she'd said, but registering that she had spoken. His brow was furrowed, and he seemed tight-lipped and pale. She put a hand on his arm, squeezing in reassurance, and he glanced at her with a faint smile, his face easing. An unearthly wail cut through the air, and Brianna froze, clutching Roger's arm. It rose to a shriek, then broke in a series of short, jerky gulps, coming down a scale of sobs like a dead body rolling down a staircase. Goose flesh prickled down her spine and her stomach clenched. She glanced at Roger. He looked nearly as pale as she felt, though he pressed her hand reassuringly.
"That will be the Bantram," her father remarked calmly. "I didn't ken there was one."
"Neither did I," said her mother. "Who do you suppose it is?" She had startled too at the sound of it, but now looked merely interested. Roger had been holding his breath too. He let it out now with a small rattling sound and cleared his throat.
"A mourning woman," he said.
The words emerged thickly, and he cleared his throat again, much harder.
"They, keen. After the coffin."
The voice rose again out of the wood, this time with a more deliberate sound. Brianna thought there were words in the wailing, but couldn't make them out.
"Wendigo."
The word came unbidden into her mind, and she shivered convulsively. Jimmy whimpered, trying to burrow inside his grandfather's coat.
"It's nothing to fear, Awalach."
He patted Jimmy on the back. Jim appeared unconvinced, and put his thumb in his mouth, huddling round-eyed into Jamie's chest, as the wailing faded into moans.
"Well, come then. We'll meet her, shall we?"
Jamie turned aside and began making his way into the forest, toward the voice. There was nothing to do but follow. Brianna squeezed Roger's arm, but left him, walking close to her father, so Jimmy could see her and be reassured.
"It's okay, pal," she said softly.
The weather was growing colder, her breath puffed out in wisps of white. The end of Jemmy's nose was red, and his eyes seemed a little pink around the edges. Was he catching a cold too? She put out a hand to touch his forehead, but just then the voice broke out afresh. This time, though, something seemed to have happened to it. It was a high, thready sound, not the robust keening they'd heard before. And uncertain. "Like an apprentice ghost," she thought, in uneasy jest. An apprentice it proved to be, though not a ghost. Her father ducked under a low pine, and she followed him, emerging in a clearing facing two surprised women, or rather, a woman and a teenaged girl, with shawls wrapped over their heads. She knew them. But what were their names?
"Matin war a weichter," the older woman said, recovering from her surprise and dropping into a low curtsy to Jamie.
"Good morning to you, sir."
"And to you, my mistresses," he replied, also in Gaelic.
"Good morning, Mrs. Gwilty,"
Roger said, in his soft, hoarse voice.
"And to you, Aenean,"
he added, bowing courteously to the girl.
Olana, that was it.
Brianna recalled the round face, just like the O that began her name. She was Mrs. Gwilty's daughter? Or her niece?
"Ah, bonny boy," the girl crooned, reaching out a finger to touch Jem's rounded cheek.
He pulled back a little and sucked harder on his thumb, watching her suspiciously under the edge of his blue woolly bonnet. The women spoke no English, but Brianna's Gaelic was sufficient by now to allow her to follow the conversation, if not to join fluently in it. Mrs. Gwilty was, she explained, showing her niece the way of a proper, Coronach.
And a fine job of work you will make of it between you, I'm sure, Jamie said politely.
Mrs. Gwilty sniffed and gave her niece a disparaging look.
Mm-hmm, she said,
a voice like a bat farting. But she is the only woman left of my family, and I shall not live forever.
Roger made a small choking noise, which he hastily developed into a convincing cough. Olana's pleasant round face, already flushed from the cold, went a blotchy red, but she said nothing, merely cast her eyes down and huddled deeper into her shawl. It was a dark brown homespun, Brianna saw. Mrs. Gwilty's was a fine wool, dyed black, and if it was a trifle frayed around the edges, she wore it still with the dignity of her profession.
"It is sorrowful we are for you," Jamie said, in formal condolence. "She who is gone?"
He paused in delicate inquiry.
"My father's sister," answered Mrs. Gwilty promptly.
"Woe, woe that she should be buried among strangers."
She had a lean, underfed face, the spare flesh deeply hollowed and bruised-looking round dark eyes. She turned these deep-set eyes on Jimmy, who promptly grabbed the edge of his bonnet and pulled it down over his face. Seeing the dark, bottomless eyes swivel in her direction, Brianna was hard-pressed not to do the same.
"I hope that her shade will find comfort with your family being here," Claire said in her halting Gaelic.
It sounded most peculiar in her mother's English accent, and Brianna saw her father bite his lower lip in order not to smile.
"She will not lack company for long," Olana blurted it out, then, catching Jamie's eye, went beet red and buried her nose in her shawl. This odd statement seemed to make sense to her father, who nodded.
"Och, so, who is it ails?"
He looked at her mother in question, but she shook her head slightly. If anyone was sick, they hadn't sought her help.
Mrs. Gwilty's long-seamed upper lip pressed down over dreadful teeth. "Seamus Buchan," she remarked with grim satisfaction. "He lies fevered, and his chest will kill him before the week is out. But we've beaten him. A fortunate thing."
"What?" said Claire, frowning in bewilderment.
Mrs. Gwilty's eyes narrowed at her.
"The last person buried in a graveyard must stand watch over it, Sassenach," Jamie explained in English, "until another comes to take his place."
Switching smoothly back to Gaelic, he said,
"Fortunate is she, and the more fortunate in having such a bantrem to follow her."
He put a hand into his pocket and handed over a coin, which Mrs. Gwilty glanced at, then blinked and looked again.
"Ah," she said, gratified. "Well, we will do our best, the girl and I. Come then, Anian, let me hear you."
Olana, thus pressed to perform before company, looked terrified. Under her aunt's monitory eye, though, there was no escape. Closing her eyes, she inflated her chest, thrust back her shoulders, and emitted a piercing before breaking off, gasping for breath. Roger flinched as though the sound were bamboo splinters being shoved under his fingernails, and Claire's mouth dropped open. Jamie's shoulders were hunched up round his ears, and he clung to his grandfather's coat like a small blue burr. Even Jamie looked a little startled.
"Not bad," said Mrs. Gwilty judiciously. "Perhaps it will not be a complete disgrace."
"I am hearing that Hiram asked you to speak a word," she added, with a disparaging glance at Roger.
"He has," Roger replied, still hoarse, but as firmly as possible. "I am honoured."
Mrs. Gwilty didn't reply to this, but merely looked him up and down, then, shaking her head, turned her back and raised her arms. She wailed in a voice that made Brianna feel ice crystals in her blood.
"Woe, woe,
Whoa! Ah! Ah! Woe is come to the house of Crombie! Woe!
Dutifully turning her back on them as well, Olana joined in with a descant wail of her own. Claire, rather untactfully, but practically, put her fingers in her ears. "How much did you give them?" she asked Jamie in English. Jamie's shoulders shook briefly, and he hastily ushered her away, a firm hand on her elbow. Besides Brianna, Roger swallowed, the sound just audible under the noise.
"You should have had that drink," she said to him.
"I know,"
he said hoarsely, and sneezed. "Have you even heard of Seamus Buchan?" I asked Jamie as we picked our way across the sodden earth of the Crombies' dooryard. "Who is he?"
"Oh, I've heard of him, aye," he replied, putting an arm round me to help me across a fetid puddle of what looked like goat urine. "Oof! God, you're a solid wee thing, Satanach!"
"That's the basket," I replied absently. "I believe Mrs. Bugs put lead shot in it. Or maybe only fruitcake."
"Who is he, then?
One of the fisher folk?"
"Aye. He's great-uncle to Maisie McArdle. Her who's married to him that was a boat-builder. You recall her? Red hair and a very long nose. Sixpence."
"Vaguely? However do you remember these things?" I demanded. But he merely smiled and offered me his arm. I took it, and we strode gravely through the mud and the scattered straw laid down across it. The laird and his lady come to the funeral. The door of the cabin was open, despite the cold, to let the spirit of the dead go out. Fortunately, it also let a little light come in, as the cabin was crudely built and had no windows. It was also completely packed with people, most of whom hadn't bathed any time in the preceding 4 months. I was no stranger to claustrophobic cabins or unwashed bodies, though, and since I knew that one of the bodies present was probably clean but certainly dead, I'd already begun breathing through my mouth by the time one of the Crombie daughters, shawled and red-eyed, invited us in. Granny Wilson was laid out on the table with a candle at her head, wrapped in the shroud she had no doubt woven as a new bride. The linen cloth was yellowed and creased with age, but clean and soft in the candlelight, embroidered on the edges with a simple pattern of vine leaves. It had been carefully kept, brought from Scotland at the cost of who knew what pains. Jamie paused at the door, removing his hat, and murmured formal condolences, which the Crombies, male and female, accepted with nods and grunts respectively. I handed over the basket of food and nodded back with what I hoped was a suitable expression of dignified sympathy, keeping an eye on Jemmy. Brianna had done her best to explain to him, but I had no idea what he might make of the situation or the corpse. He had been persuaded, with some difficulty, to emerge from his bonnet and was looking round now with interest, his cowlick standing on end.
"Is that the dead lady, Grandma?"
he whispered loudly to me, pointing at the body.
"Yes, dear," I said,
with an uneasy glance at old Mrs. Wilson. She looked perfectly all right, though, done up properly in her best cap, with a bandage under her jaw to keep her mouth closed, dry eyelids sealed against the glimmer of the candle. I didn't think Jemmy had ever met the old lady in life. There was no real reason for him to be upset at seeing her dead. And he'd been taken hunting regularly since he could walk. He certainly understood the concept of death. Besides, a corpse was definitely anticlimactic after our encounter with the Bantram. Still,
"We'll pay our respects now, lad," Jamie said quietly to him, and set him on the floor.
I caught Jamie's glance at the door, where Roger and Bree were murmuring condolences in their turn, and realized he had been waiting for them to catch up so that they could watch with him and know what to do next. He led Jemmy through the press of people who gave way respectfully and up to the table where he laid his hand on the corpse's chest.
Oh, so it was that sort of funeral.
At some Highland funerals, it was the custom for everyone to touch the body so that the dead person shouldn't haunt them. I doubted that Granny Wilson would have any interest in haunting me, but care never hurt. And I did have an uneasy memory of a skull with silver fillings in its teeth, and my encounter with what might have been its possessor, seen by corpse light on a Black Mountain night. Despite myself, I glanced at the candle, but it seemed a perfectly normal thing of brown beeswax, pleasantly fragrant, and leaning a little crooked in its pottery candlestick. Steeling myself, I leaned over and laid my own hand gently on the shroud. An earthenware saucer, holding a piece of bread and a heap of salt, sat on the dead woman's chest, and a small wooden bowl filled with dark liquid, wine, sat beside her on the table. What with the good beeswax candle, the salt and the bantram, it looked as though Hiram Crombie was trying to do right by his late mother-in-law. Though I wouldn't put it past him to thriftily reuse the salt after the funeral. Something seemed wrong, though. An air of uneasiness curled among the cracked boots and rag-wrapped feet of the crowd, like the cold draught from the door. At first, I had thought it might be due to our presence, but that wasn't it. There had been a brief exhalation of approval when Jamie approached the body. Jamie whispered to Jemmy, then boosted him up, legs dangling, to touch the corpse. He showed no reluctance and peered into the dead woman's waxen face with interest.
"What's that for?"
he asked loudly, reaching for the bread.
"Is she going to eat it?"
Jamie grabbed his wrist and planted his hand firmly on the shroud instead.
"That's for the sin-eater, Awalach. Leave it, aye?"
"What's a..."
"Later."
No one argued with Jamie when he used that tone of voice, and Jemmy subsided, putting his thumb back in his mouth as Jamie set him down. Bree came up and scooped him into her arms, belatedly remembering to touch the corpse herself, and murmur, "God rest you." Then Roger stepped forward, and there was a stir of interest among the crowd. He looked pale, but composed. His face was lean and rather ascetic, usually saved from sternness by the gentleness of his eyes and a mobile mouth ready to laugh. This was no time for laughter, though, and his eyes were bleak in the dim light. He laid a hand on the dead woman's chest and bowed his head. I wasn't sure whether he was praying for the repose of her soul or for inspiration, but he stayed that way for more than a minute. The crowd watched respectfully, with no sound save coughs and the clearing of throats. Roger wasn't the only one catching a cold, I thought. And thought suddenly again of Seamus Buchan.
"He lies fevered, and his chest will kill him before the week is out,"
so Mrs. Gwilty had said. Pneumonia, perhaps, or bronchitis, or even consumption. And no one had told me. I felt a slight pang at that, equal parts annoyance, guilt, and unease. I knew the new tenants didn't yet trust me. I had thought that I should allow them to get used to me before I started dropping in on them at random. Many of them would never have seen an English person before coming to the colonies, and I was well aware of their attitude toward both Sassenachs and Catholics. But evidently there was now a man dying virtually on my doorstep, and I hadn't even known of his existence, let alone his illness. Should I go to see him as soon as the funeral was over? But where in bloody hell did the man live? It couldn't be very close. I did know all the fisher folk who had settled down the mountain. The McArdles must be up across the ridge. I stole a look at the door, trying to judge how soon the threatening clouds would cut loose their burden of snow. There were shufflings and the murmurs of low speech outside. More people had arrived, coming up from the nearby hollows, crowding round the door.
I caught the word Jan Kairish in a questioning tone,
and suddenly realised what was odd about the present occasion. There was no wake. Customarily, the body would have been washed and laid out, but then kept on display for a day or two, to allow everyone in the area time to come and pay their regards. Listening intently, I caught a distinct tone of disgruntlement and surprise. The neighbours thought this haste unseemly.
Why isn't there a wick?
I whispered to Jamie. He lifted one shoulder a fraction of an inch, but nodded toward the door and the muffled sky beyond.
There's going to be a great deal of snow by nightfall, Ahuja, he said, and likely to go on for days by the looks of it. I wouldn't want to be having to dig a grave and bury a coffin in the midst of that myself. And should it snow for days, where are they going to put the body in the meantime? That's true, McDo, said Kenny Lindsay, overhearing.
He glanced round at the people near us and edged closer, lowering his voice.
But it's true, too, as Hiram Crombie's no hour fond of the old his good mother.
He raised his chin a fraction, indicating the corpse.
Some see as he canna get the old woman underground fast enough, before she changes her mind, aye?
He grinned briefly, and Jamie hid his own smile, looking down.
Saves a bit on the food, too, I suppose.
Hiram's reputation as a cheapskate was well known, which was saying something among the thrifty but hospitable Highlanders. A fresh bustle was taking place outside as new arrivals came. There was a sort of congestion at the door as someone sought to press inside, though the house was filled shoulder to shoulder with the only bit of open floor space left under the table on which Mrs. Wilson reposed. The people near the door gave way reluctantly, and Mrs. Bugg surged into the cabin, arrayed in her best cap and shawl, arch at her shoulder.
"You forgot the whisky, sir," she informed Jamie, handing him a corked bottle.
Looking round, she at once spotted the Crombies and bowed to them ceremoniously, murmuring sympathy. Bobbing upright, she set her cap straight and looked expectantly round. Clearly the festivities could now commence. Hiram Crombie glanced round, then nodded to Roger. Roger drew himself up slightly, nodded back, and began. He spoke simply for a few minutes, generalities about the preciousness of life, the enormity of death, and the importance of kin and neighbours in facing such things. This all seemed to be going over well with the punters, who were nodding slightly in approval and seemed to be settling down in expectation of decent entertainment. Roger paused to cough and blow his nose, then shifted into what appeared to be some version of the Presbyterian funeral service, or what he recalled of it from his life with the Reverend Wakefield. This too seemed to be acceptable. Bree seemed to relax a little and put Jemmy down. It was going well, and yet I was still conscious of a faint sense of uneasiness. Part of that, of course, was that I could see Roger. The growing warmth of the cabin was making his nose run. He kept his handkerchief in his hand, dabbing furtively, and now and then stopping to blow his nose as discreetly as possible. Phlegm, though, runs downhill, and as the congestion got worse, it began to affect his vulnerable throat. The choked note in his voice, always present, was getting noticeably worse. He was having to clear his throat repeatedly in order to speak. Beside me, Jemmy stirred restively, and from the corner of my eye I saw Bree put a hand on his head to quiet him. He looked up at her, but her attention was fixed anxiously on Roger.
"We give thanks to God for the life of this woman," he said,
and paused to clear his throat again. I found myself doing it with him in sheer nervous sympathy.
"She is a servant of God, faithful and true, and now praises him before his throne with the saints."
I saw sudden doubt flicker across his face as to whether his present congregation countenanced the concept of saints, or would consider such a mention to be Romish heresy. He coughed and resumed,
"With the angels."
Evidently angels were innocuous. The faces around me looked somber, but unoffended. Exhaling visibly, Roger picked up the little green Bible and opened it at a marked page.
"Let us speak together a psalm in praise of him who..."
He glanced at the page and, too late, realized the difficulty of translating an English psalm into Gaelic on the wing. He cleared his throat explosively, and half a dozen throats among the crowd echoed him in reflex. On my other side, Jamie murmured, "Oh, God," in heartfelt prayer.
Jamie tugged at his mother's skirt, whispering something, but was peremptorily shushed. I could see Bree yearning toward Roger, body tensed in the urgent desire to help somehow, if only by mental telepathy. With no alternative in sight, Roger began to read the psalm haltingly. Half the crowd had taken him at his word when he invited them to speak together, and were reciting the psalm from memory several times faster than he could read. I closed my eyes, unable to watch, but there was no way to avoid hearing as the congregation ripped through the psalm and fell silent, waiting in dour patience for Roger to stumble his way to the end, which he did, doggedly. "Amen," said Jamie loudly, and alone. I opened my eyes to find everyone staring at us, with looks ranging from mild surprise to glowering hostility. Jamie took a deep breath and let it out very slowly. "Jesus Christ," he said, very softly. A bead of sweat ran down Roger's cheek, and he wiped it away with the sleeve of his coat. "Would anyone wish to say a few words regarding the deceased?" he asked, glancing from face to face. Silence and the whine of the wind answered him. He cleared his throat, and someone snickered.
"Granny,"
whispered Jemmy, tugging on my skirt.
"Shh." "But Grandma..."
The sense of urgency in his voice made me turn and look down at him.
"Do you need to go to the privy?"
I whispered, bending down to him. He shook his head, violently enough to make the heavy mop of red-gold hair flop to and fro on his forehead.
"O God, our Heavenly Father, who art leading us through the changes of time to the rest and blessedness of eternity, be thou near to us now, to comfort and to uphold..."
I glanced up to see that Roger had laid his hand once more on the corpse, evidently deciding to bring the proceedings to a close. From the relief evident in his face and voice, I thought he must be falling back on some accustomed prayer from the Book of Common Worship, familiar enough to him that he could manage it with fair fluency in Gaelic.
"Make us to know that thy children are precious in thy sight."
He stopped, visibly struggling. The muscles of his throat worked, trying vainly to clear the obstruction in silence. But it was no good. A sound, not quite laughter, ran through the room, and Bree made a small rumbling in her own throat, like a volcano getting ready to spew lava.
"Granny!"
"Shh!" "At thy sight, that they live evermore with thee, and that thy mercy..."
"Granny!"
Jemmy was wiggling, as though a colony of ants had taken up residence in his breeches, an expression of agonized urgency on his face.
"I am the resurrection and the life, saith the Lord. He that believeth in me, though he were dead, yet shall he live."
With the end in sight, Roger was making a gallant finish, forcing his voice past its limits, hoarser than ever, and cracking on every other word, but firm and loud.
"Just a minute," I hissed. "I'll take you out in a..." "No, Granny, look."
I followed his out-thrust finger, and for a moment thought he was pointing at his father. But he wasn't. Old Mrs. Wilson had opened her eyes. There was an instant silence as everyone's eyes fastened at once on Mrs. Wilson. Then there was a collective gasp and an instinctive stepping back with shrieks of dismay and cries of pain as toes were trodden on and people squashed against the unyielding rough logs of the walls. Jamie grabbed Jemmy up off the floor in time to save his being crushed, inflated his lungs and bellowed, "Hoss!" at the top of his voice. Such was his volume that the crowd did indeed freeze momentarily, long enough for him to thrust Jemmy into Brianna's arms and elbow his way toward the table. Roger had got hold of the erstwhile corpse and was lifting her into a sitting position, her hand feebly flapping at the bandage round her jaws. I pushed after Jamie, ruthlessly shoving people out of the way. "Give her a bit of air, please," I said, raising my voice. The stunned silence was giving way to a rising murmur of excitement, but this quelled as I fumbled to untie the bandage. The room waited in quivering expectation as the corpse worked stiff jaws.
"Where am I?" she said, in a quavering voice.
Her gaze passed disbelievingly round the room, settling at last on her daughter's face.
"Mary,"
she said dubiously, and Mrs. Crombie rushed forward and fell on her knees, bursting into tears as she gripped her mother's hands.
"Avar! Avar!" she cried.
The old woman set a trembling hand on her daughter's hair, looking as though she weren't quite sure she was real. I, meanwhile, had been doing my best to check the old lady's vital signs, which were not all that vital, but nonetheless fairly good for someone who had been dead a moment before. Respiration very shallow, laboured, a colour like weak old oatmeal, cold, clammy skin despite the heat in the room, and I couldn't find a pulse at all, though plainly she must have one, mustn't she? "How do you feel?" I asked. She put a trembling hand to her belly.
"I do feel that wee bit poorly," she whispered.
I put my own hand on her abdomen and felt it instantly. A pulse where no pulse should be. It was irregular, stumbling and bumping, but most assuredly there. "Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ," I said. I didn't say it loudly, but Mrs. Crombie gasped, and I saw her apron twitch as she doubtless made the horns beneath it. I hadn't time to bother with apology, but stood and grabbed Roger by the sleeve, pulling him aside. "She has an aortic aneurysm," I said to him, very softly. "She must have been bleeding internally for some time, enough to make her lose consciousness and seem cold. It's going to rupture very soon, and then she'll die for real." He swallowed audibly, his face very pale, but said only, "Do you know how long?" I glanced at Mrs. Wilson. Her face was the same grey as the snow-laden sky, and her eyes were going in and out of focus, like the flickering of a candle in a wind. "I see," Roger said, though I hadn't spoken. He took a deep breath and cleared his throat. The crowd, which had been hissing amongst themselves like a flock of agitated geese, ceased at once. Every eye in the place was riveted on the tableau before them. "This, our sister, has been restored to life, as we all shall be one day by the grace of God," Roger said softly. "It is a sign to us of hope and faith. She will go soon again to the arms of the angels, but has come back to us for a moment, to bring us assurance of God's love." He paused a moment, obviously groping for something further to say. He cleared his throat and bent his head toward Mrs. Wilson's. "Did you wish to say anything, O Mother?" he whispered in Gaelic.
"Aye, I do."
Mrs. Wilson seemed to be gaining strength, and with it, indignation. A faint pinkness showed in her waxy cheeks as she glared round at the crowd.
"What sort of week is this, Hiram Crombie?"
she demanded, fixing her son-in-law with a gimlet eye.
"I see nae food laid out, nae drink. And what is this?"
Her voice rose in a furious squeak, her eye having fallen on the plate of bread and salt, which Roger had hastily set aside when he lifted her.
"Why?"
She looked wildly round at the assembled crowd, and the truth of it dawned upon her. Her sunken eyes bulged.
"Why, ye shameless skinflint, this is nae week at all. You've meant to bury me with nothing but a crust of bread and a drop of wine for the sin-eater, and I wonder ye spared that. Nae doot you'll thieve the winding clays from my corpse to make clouts for your snotty-nosed bairns. And where's my good brooch I said I wanted to be buried with?"
One scrawny hand closed on her shrunken bosom, catching a fistful of wilted linen.
"Mary, my brooch!"
"Here it is, Mother, here it is."
Poor Mrs. Crombie, altogether undone, was fumbling in her pocket, sobbing and gasping.
I put it away to be safe. I meant to put it on you before...
She came out with an ugly lump of garnets, which her mother snatched from her, cradling it against her breast and glaring round with jealous suspicion. Clearly she suspected her neighbours of waiting the chance to steal it from her body. I heard an offended inhalation from the woman standing behind me, but had no time to turn and see who it was. "Now, now," I said, using my best soothing bedside manner. "I'm sure everything will be all right. Aside from the fact that you're going to die in the next few minutes, that is," I thought, suppressing a hysterical urge to laugh inappropriately. Actually, it might be in the next few seconds if her blood pressure rose any higher. I had my fingers on the thumping big pulse in her abdomen that betrayed the fatal weakening of her abdominal aorta. It had to have begun to leak already to make her lose consciousness to such a degree as to seem dead. Eventually, she would simply blow a gasket, and that would be that. Roger and Jamie were both doing their best to soothe her, muttering in English and Gaelic, and patting her comfortingly. She seemed to be responding to this treatment, though still breathing like a steam engine. Jamie's production of the bottle of whiskey from his pocket helped still further.
"Well, that's more like it," Mrs. Wilson said, somewhat mollified as he hastily pulled the cork and waved the bottle under her nose so she could appreciate the quality of it. "And you've brought food, too?"
Mrs. Bug had bustled her way to the front, basket held before her like a battering ram.
"Hmm. I never thought I should live to see papists kinder than my ain kin."
This last was directed at Hiram Crombie, who had so far been opening and closing his mouth without finding anything whatever to say in reply to his mother-in-law's tirade.
Why,
he stammered in outrage, torn between shock, obvious fury, and a need to justify himself before his neighbours.
"Kinder than your ain kin! Why, have I not given ye him these 20 years past? Fed and clothed ye as ye were my ain mither? Borne your wicked tongue and foul tempers for years and never?"
Jamie and Roger both leapt in to try to stifle him, but instead interrupted each other, and in the confusion Hiram was allowed to go on speaking his mind, which he did. So did Mrs. Wilson, who was no slouch at invective either. The pulse in her belly was throbbing under my hand, and I was hard put to it to keep her from leaping off the table and dotting Hiram with the bottle of whiskey. The neighbours were agog. Roger took matters, and Mrs. Wilson, firmly into his own hands, seizing her by her scrawny shoulders.
"Mrs. Wilson,"
he said hoarsely, but loudly enough to drown Hiram's indignant rebuttal of Mrs. Wilson's most recent depiction of his character.
"Mrs. Wilson!"
"Eh?"
She paused for breath, blinking up at him in momentary confusion.
"Cease! And you too!"
He glared at Hiram, who was opening his mouth again. Hiram shut it.
"I'll no have this,"
Roger said, and thumped the Bible down on the table.
"It's not fitting, and I'll not have it. Do you hear me?"
He glowered from one to the other of the combatants, black brows low and fierce. The room was silent, bar Hiram's heavy breathing, Mrs. Crombie's small sobs, and Mrs. Wilson's faint, asthmatic wheeze.
"Now then,"
Roger said, still glaring round to prevent any further interruptions. He put a hand over Mrs. Wilson's thin, aged, spotted one.
"Mrs. Wilson, do you not ken that you stand before God this minute?"
He darted a look at me and I nodded. Yes, she was definitely going to die. Her head was wobbling on her neck, and the glow of anger fading from her eyes even as he spoke.
"God is near to us,"
he said, lifting his head to address the congregation at large. He repeated this in Gaelic, and there was a sort of collective sigh. He narrowed his eyes at them.
"We will not profane this holy occasion with anger, nor bitterness. Now, sister."
He squeezed her hand gently.
compose your soul. God will.
But Mrs. Wilson was no longer listening. Her withered mouth dropped open in horror.
The sin-eater,
she cried, looking wildly round. She grabbed the dish from the table next to her, showering salt down the front of her winding sheet.
Where is the sin-eater?
Hiram stiffened as though goosed with a red-hot poker, then whirled and fought his way toward the door, the crowd giving way before him. Murmurs of speculation rose in his wake, only to stop abruptly as a piercing wail rose from outside, another rising behind it as the first one fell. An awed "Ooh!" rose from the crowd, and Mrs. Wilson looked gratified as the Bantram started in to earn their money in earnest. Then there was a stirring near the door, and the crowd parted like the Red Sea, leaving a narrow path to the table. Mrs. Wilson sat bolt upright, dead white and barely breathing. The pulse in her abdomen skittered and jumped under my fingers. Roger and Jamie had hold of her arms, supporting her. A complete hush had fallen over the room. The only sounds were the howling of the Bantram outside, and slow, shuffling footsteps, soft on the ground outside, then suddenly louder on the boards of the floor. The sin-eater had arrived. He was a tall man, or had been once. It was impossible to tell his age. Either years or illness had eaten away his flesh, so that his wide shoulders bowed and his spine had hunched, a gaunt head poking forward, crowned with a balding straggle of greying strands. I glanced up at Jamie, eyebrows raised. I'd never seen the man before. He shrugged slightly. He didn't know him either. As the sin-eater came closer, I saw that his body was crooked. He seemed caved in on one side, ribs perhaps crushed by some accident. Every eye was fixed on the man, but he met none of them, keeping his gaze focused on the floor. The path to the table was narrow, but the people shrank back as he passed, careful that he shouldn't touch them. Only when he reached the table did he lift his head, and I saw that one eye was missing, evidently clawed away by a bear, judging from the welted mass of scar tissue. The other one was working. He halted in surprise, seeing Mrs. Wilson, and glanced round, obviously unsure what to do next. She wiggled one arm free of Roger's grip and pushed the dish containing the bread and salt toward him.
"Get on, then," she said, her voice high and a little frightened. "But you're not dead."
It was a soft, educated voice, betraying only puzzlement. But the crowd reacted as though it had been the hissing of a serpent, and recoiled further, if such a thing were possible.
"Well, what of it?"
Agitation was making Mrs. Wilson tremble even more. I could feel a small, constant vibration through the table.
"You've been paid to eat my sins. Be after doing it, then."
A thought occurred to her, and she jerked upright, squinting at her son-in-law.
"You did pay him, Hiram."
Hiram was still flushed from the previous exchanges, but went a sort of puce at this, and clutched at his side. Clutching at his purse, I thought, rather than his heart.
"Well, I'm no going to pay him before he's done the job," he snapped. "What sort of way is that to be carrying on?"
Seeing renewed riot about to break out, Jamie let go his hold on Mrs. Wilson and fumbled hastily in his sporran, emerging with a silver shilling, which he thrust across at the sin-eater, though careful, I saw, not to touch the man.
"Now you've been paid," he said gruffly, nodding to him. "Best be about your business, sir."
The man looked slowly round the room, and the intake of breath from the crowd was audible, even over the wails of
"Ooh, to the house of Crombie,"
going on outside. He was standing no more than a foot away from me, close enough that I could smell the sweet sour odour of him, ancient sweat and dirt in his rags, and something else, some faint aroma that spoke of pustulant sores and unhealed wounds.
He turned his head and looked straight at me. It was a soft brown eye, amber in colour, and startlingly like my own. Meeting his gaze gave me a queer feeling in the pit of the stomach, as though I looked for a moment into a distorting mirror and saw that cruelly misshapen face replace my own. He didn't change expression, and yet I felt something nameless pass between us. Then he turned his head away and reached out a long, weathered, very dirty hand to pick up the piece of bread. A sort of sigh went through the room as he ate, slowly gumming the bread, for he had few teeth. I could feel Mrs. Wilson's pulse, much lighter now, and fast, like a hummingbird's. She hung nearly limp in the men's grasp, the withered lids of her eyes drooping as she watched. He wrapped both hands around the cup of wine, as though it were a chalice, and drank it down, eyes closed. He set the empty cup down and looked at Mrs. Wilson, curiously. I supposed he never had met one of his clients alive before, and wondered how long he had fulfilled this strange office. Mrs. Wilson stared into his eyes, face blank as a child's. Her abdominal pulse was skipping like a stone, a few light beats, a pause, then a thump that struck my palm like a blow, and back to its erratic jumps. The sin-eater bowed to her, very slowly. Then he snatched the shilling, turned round and scampered for the door with amazing speed for such an infirm specimen. Several of the boys and younger men near the door rushed out after him, yelling. One or two seized sticks of wood from the fire basket by the hearth. Others were torn. They glanced toward the open door, where shouts and the thumps of thrown stones mingled with the wailing of the bantram. But their eyes were drawn back, ineluctably, to Mrs. Wilson. She looked peaceful, was the only word. It was no surprise whatever to feel the pulse beneath my hand simply stop. Somewhere deeper in my own depths, I felt the dizzying rush of the hemorrhage begin, a flooding warmth that pulled me into it, made black spots whirl before my eyes, and caused a ringing in my ears. I knew to all intents and purposes she had now died for good. I felt her go, and yet I heard her voice above the racket, very small, but calm and clear. "I forgive ye, Hiram," she said. "Ye've been a good lad." My vision had gone dark, but I could still hear and sense things dimly. Something grasped me, pulled me away, and a moment later I came to myself, leaning against Jamie in a corner, his arms supporting me. "Are you all right, Sassenach?" he was saying urgently, shaking me a little and patting my cheek. The black-clad Bantram had come as far as the door. I could see them outside, standing like twin pillars of darkness, falling snow beginning to whirl round them as the cold wind came inside, small, hard, dry flakes skittering and bouncing in its wake across the floor. The women's voices rose and fell, blending with the wind. By the table, Hiram Crombie was trying to fix his mother-in-law's garnet brooch to her shroud, though his hand shook and his narrow face was wet with tears. "Yes," I said faintly. Then, "Yes," a little stronger. "Everything is all right now." Part 6. On the Mountain. Chapter 40. Bird Spring. March 1774. It was spring, and the long months of desolation melted into running water, with streamlets pouring from every hill and miniature waterfalls leaping from stone to stone to stone. The air was filled with the racket of birds, a cacophony of melody that replaced the lonely calling of geese passing by, far overhead. Birds go one by one in the winter. A single raven hunched broodingly in a barren tree, an owl fluffed against the cold in the high dark shadows of a barn. Or they go in flocks, a massed thunder of wings to bear them up and away,
wheeling through the sky like hands full of pepper grains thrown aloft, calling their way in V's of mournful courage toward the promise of a distant and problematic survival. In winter, the raptors draw apart into themselves. The songbirds flee away, all the colour of the feathered world reduced to the brutal simplification of predator and prey, grey shadows passing overhead, with no more than a small, bright drop of blood fallen back to earth here and there to mark the passing of life, leaving a drift of scattered feathers borne on the wind. But as spring blooms, the birds grow drunk with love, and the bushes riot with their songs. Far, far into the night, darkness mutes but doesn't silence them, and small, melodious conversations break out at all hours, invisible and strangely intimate in the dead of night, as though one overheard the lovemaking of strangers in the room next door. I moved closer to Jamie, hearing the clear, sweet song of a thrush in the great red spruce that stood behind the house. It was still cold at night, but not with the bitter chill of winter, rather with the sweet, fresh cold of thawing earth and springing leaves, a cold that sent the blood tingling and made warm bodies seek one another, nesting. A rumbling snore echoed across the landing, another harbinger of spring. Major MacDonald, who had arrived mud-caked and wind-bitten the night before, bringing unwelcome news of the outside world. Jamie stirred briefly at the sound, groaned, farted briefly, and lay still. He'd stayed up late entertaining the Major, if entertainment was the word for it. I could hear Lizzie and Mrs. Bug in the kitchen below, talking as they banged pots and slammed doors in hopes of rousing us. Breakfast smells began to rise up the stairs, enticing, the bitter smell of roasting chicory spicing the thick warmth of buttered porridge. The sound of Jamie's breathing had changed, and I knew he was awake, though he still lay with his eyes closed. I didn't know whether this denoted an urge to continue the physical pleasure of sleep, or a marked disinclination to get up and deal with Major MacDonald. He resolved this doubt at once by rolling over, enveloping me in his arms, and moving his lower body against mine in a manner that made it obvious that while physical pleasure was what was on his mind, he was quite through sleeping. He hadn't reached the point of coherent speech yet, though, and nuzzled my ear, making small, interrogatory hums in his throat. Well, the Major was still asleep, and the coffee, such as it was, wouldn't be ready for a bit. I hummed back, reached the bedside table for a bit of almond cream, and commenced a slow and pleasurable rummage through the layers of bedclothes and nightshirt to apply it. Some small while later, snorts and thumps across the hall denoted the resurrection of Major MacDonald, and the delectable scents of frying ham and potatoes with onions had joined the throng of olfactory stimuli. The sweet smell of almond cream was stronger, though. "Greased lightning," Jamie said, with a drowsy air of satisfaction. He was still in bed, lying on his side to watch me dress. "What?" I turned from my looking-glass to eye him. "Who?" "Me, I suppose. Or were you not thunderstruck, there at the end?" He laughed almost silently, rustling the bedclothes. "Oh, you've been talking to Bree again," I said tolerantly. I turned back to the glass. "That particular figure of speech is a metaphor for extreme speed, not lubricated brilliance." I smiled at him in the glass as I brushed knots out of my hair. He had unplaited it while I was anointing him, and subsequent exertions had caused it to explode. Come to think, it did faintly resemble the effects of electrocution.
"Well, that can be fast, too," he said judiciously, sitting up and rubbing a hand through his own hair. "But not first thing in the morning. There are worse ways to wake up, aye?"
"Yes, much worse." Sounds of hawking and spitting came from across the landing, followed by the distinctive sound of someone with very vigorous bladder function employing a chamber pot. "Is he staying long, did he say?" Jamie shook his head. Rising slowly, he stretched himself like a cat, and then came across in his shirt to put his arms around me. I hadn't yet poked up the fire, and the room was chilly, His body was pleasantly warm. He rested his chin on top of my head, regarding our stacked reflections in the mirror.
"I'll have to go," he said softly. "Tomorrow, perhaps."
I stiffened a little, brush in hand. "Where?" "To the Indians." He nodded, eyes on mine.
"MacDonald brought newspapers with the text of letters from Governor Martin to various people. Tryon in New York, General Gage, asking help. He's losing his grip upon the colony, insofar as he ever had one, and is seriously thinking of arming the Indians. Though that bit of information hasn't made it into the newspapers, and a good thing, too."
He released me and reached for the drawer where his clean shirts and stockings stayed. "That is a good thing," I said, bundling back my hair and hunting for a ribbon to tie it with.